What I find fascinating in our industry is the fact that we live in an ever-changing world. There's always new financial instruments, new ways to implement a given strategy, new tools at our disposal to invest. I can think here about machine learning, artificial intelligence. So it's using all the tools that we have at our disposal to make the most appropriate investment decision. And so it's very important that you stay on top of all those innovations.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager, due diligence, or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
For me, the best part of my podcasting journey has been the opportunity to speak to a huge range of extraordinary investors from all around the world. In this series, I have invited one of them, namely Alan Dunn, to host a series of in-depth conversations on the topic of what it takes to be a world-class allocator. In today's world, portfolio construction is fast moving to the top of the agenda of many investors as they try to analyze and understand the riskiness of their portfolios. And with ever-increasing uncertainty around the globe, being well-diversified across many different strategies and themes in your portfolio can mean the difference between ruin and survival when the next crisis emerges. The aim of these conversations is to try and understand the experiences that have influenced these highly specialized allocators and the processes they follow to harness the best returns for their clients so that we can all become better informed investors. And with that, please welcome Alan Dunn.
Thanks for that introduction, Niels. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Christoph Lai-Elek. Christoph is Managing Director of Public Markets at University Pension Plan Ontario. UPP is the defined benefit pension plan for Ontario's university sector and has just under $11 billion Canadian dollars in assets under management. Christoph is responsible for UPP's global investment strategy with a particular focus on public markets. He has been an allocator for many years. Prior to being at UPP, he was a senior principal in capital markets at Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. Christoph, great to have you with us today. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Alan. Very happy to be here with you today.
Good stuff. Well, great to have you on. And I gave a brief introduction to your background, but maybe it would be good to hear from you about how you got involved and interested in financial markets and investing and what's taken you to your current role at UPP.
Definitely. I believe I have had an eclectic career, getting exposure to different kind of roles in the capital markets industry. All started when I did my 6 months end of school internship within the fixed income financial engineering department at BNP Paribas in Paris. At the end of my term there, I was offered a contract to work within the fixed income trading room of BNP Paribas in Hong Kong. There, I was responsible for the support and development of front office application. Front office application ranging from prices to performance and risk reporting tools. At the end of that contract, I went back to Europe and joined a small asset management company based in Geneva, Switzerland, called Mignon Genève, that was looking at diversifying their fund of fund activities by launching some hedge fund products in the credit and equity space. I worked there on the equity side to ultimately launch a European systematic equity market neutral strategy, which required building from scratch all the infrastructure necessary to run this kind of strategy. So it went from building our data management capabilities, backtesting and portfolio management tools, implementing execution capabilities, and developing risk monitoring and reporting tools. This was a very formative experience that proved very useful when I moved to Canada and joined the external manager group at OTPP. My role there was to bring a quantitative approach to the management of a hedge fund and private credit portfolios. And later on, we added a long-only equity program from both a bottom-up and top-down perspectives. So bottom-up, by providing a quantitative support to the qualitative manager selection and monitoring process, and top-down by setting up a portfolio construction and risk management framework. I spent 11 years there, and then I moved on to join UPP in March 2021, so 3 years ago, to prepare for the launch of this newly formed pension plan by implementing the infrastructure required to take over the management of the asset and liabilities of UPP's funding universities pension plans. And this included, of course, the onboarding of their assets. As you stated, I am now leading a team of 8 people covering the active public markets activities of the plan, active public equity, active public credit, and absolute return strategies.
Good stuff. Well, you mentioned it's something of a new initiative, this UPP. I think it's a consolidation of a number of universities' pensions. So maybe give us a sense on that, and then obviously what the overall investment objective, I guess, of the portfolio is.
Definitely. So our purpose is to consolidate pension plan of universities across Ontario. Our focus is on building stable and sustainable value for our members now and in the future. As of the end of December 2022, we have $10.8 billion in net assets, and the plan is fully funded with a slight surplus. We serve over 39,000 members from 16 participating employers. This includes 4 universities: University of Toronto, University of Guelph, Queen's University, and Trent University, and 12 affiliated organizations. Our ambition is to attract all the universities in Ontario, and that's what we're building UPP for. And from an AUM perspective, we are currently managing roughly 1/3 of the total AUM managed by the pension plan of these universities. One important consideration is that we're not a multi-client pension plan. We are a jointly sponsored multi-university pension plan, and we manage one portfolio of assets and one set of liabilities. We invest across all asset classes, including public and private equity, fixed income, infrastructure, and real estate. We pursue high-quality assets with risk-adjusted value, and we integrate ESG factors throughout our investing activities to derive and protect long-term value for our members. On the sustainability side, we are an engaged long-term investor that focuses on creating sustainable value in our portfolio through engagement, industry advocacy, and proxy voting. In 2022, we launched our climate action plan that includes our commitment to achieving a net zero portfolio and operations by 2040. And last year, we committed to invest at least $1.2 billion to climate solutions by 2030.
Very good. You touched on the portfolio, it's been one portfolio, I guess, one set of liabilities, and also mentioned that it's fully funded at the moment. So maybe, you know, what I mean, being fully funded, does that impact the asset allocation and give us a sense on, you know, how the asset allocation is determined, what kind of investment strategy, I guess, drives that asset allocation?
Yeah. So our main objective is to remain fully funded and to manage the funding ratio to mitigate its volatility. Our asset allocation, today we look at our portfolio by categorizing our investments, our assets, across three different main asset class group. The first one is a return-enhancing asset class, which is comprised of public equities, private credit, and hedge fund, or absolute return strategy. We have a 52% target exposure to this group of asset classes, and the breakdown is 28% to public equity, 6% to private equity, 6% to private credit, and 12% to absolute return strategy. We recently actually increased our target exposure to absolute return strategy from 10% to 12%. And that reflects our belief that in the next few years, the market environment will be supportive of active management. So we will be looking at adding returns through our absolute return strategy portfolio. The second group of asset classes is our interest rate sensitive asset classes, comprised of government bonds and inflation linked bonds. And finally, we've got an exposure to what we call the inflation sensitive asset class, that is comprised of real estate and infrastructure. Our target exposure to this group of asset classes is 16%, 8% to real estate, 8% to infrastructure. And that requires a target economic leverage of 10%.
Okay, interesting. Well, a few interesting points to pick up on there. Just picking up on the inflation sensitive, the real estate and infrastructure. Is that based on kind of research that these are the most durable kind of assets to withstand inflation, or were other assets and strategies, or is it more, things like commodities or commodity futures, I guess, are going to be reflected in absolute return, but they would also give you some kind of inflation protection or hedging. So how do you think about determining what goes in which bucket?
So inflation indexing is a characteristic that we offer as part of UPP's pension plan to our members. And so it's very important to be able to hedge that inflation indexing by investing into assets that will provide some kind of inflation protection. And here there's real estate, there's infrastructure. As you mentioned, commodities can play that role. Today, we don't have a commodity program. That's something that we started discussing, but we've got a lot of priorities, and it's not part of our top priorities for now. One challenge that we have when discussing commodity program, is how you look at this asset class from an ESG and responsible investing point of view. And that's the reason that why it requires lots of discussion amongst UPP, amongst our investment team, and as well with our members, because we want our portfolio to reflect the expectations of our members.
Okay, very good. And then on the absolute return, or sorry, the return enhancing side, you've got equity-like exposures and absolute return. And you mentioned how you've increased the absolute return exposure, reflecting your perception of a better environment. So, I mean, what would you say are those key factors that are driving that view? I mean, what do you think it is about the environment at the moment that makes it more attractive for active?
Yeah, it's about the opportunity set. After the global financial crisis, the decade that followed was characterized by central banks doing everything they can to support growth, putting basically the economy on a drip with low or even negative interest rates, which essentially cut the left tail and benefited beta and passive management. We believe that this era is over and that the next few years will be characterized with heightened level of volatility and dispersions across markets and intra-markets. And we believe that that this environment will be supportive, will be a constructive environment for active management and therefore for hedge fund strategy. And investing into absolute return strategy will provide diversification and added alpha to the traditional asset classes, so to the 60-40 portfolio, if I may say that.
Yeah, no, makes sense. And I mean, from a strategy perspective, what does that 12% look like, or how do you think about constructing an absolute return portfolio in terms of the underlying strategy makeup?
Yeah, so my goal when constructing that absolute return strategy portfolio is to construct a portfolio that is well balanced across different characteristics. One is divergence versus convergence strategies. So convergence, more relative value type of strategy, as opposed to divergence strategy that takes a directional view on markets. Here you've got global macro, you've got managed future, for example. So that's one thing we look at. We looked at as well as trust beta. So how is a strategy responding to market stress? And so we categorize our manager and our strategy across stress beta that is positive, neutral, or negative. For example, a managed future strategy is categorized as a negative stress beta strategy, because in period of stress, managed futures tend to do well based on the volatility and the dispersion that arise on the market, therefore providing some kind of support for the overall portfolio. So it's all about building a balanced portfolio across different properties, different characteristics, to have a resilient portfolio that will perform throughout market cycle and economic cycles.
And in some people, you see things like trend following managed futures that, you know, being treated more as, I guess, you know, as you call it, that negative stress beta, are being treated as kind of a portfolio diversifier or even early tail risk. But obviously, by having it in the return enhancing element of your portfolio, presumably you see it as something that can drive positive returns as much as providing protection. Is that fair to say?
Yes. So we consider trend following as a diversifying strategy that possesses crisis alpha characteristics, meaning that they tend to do well in period of stress. But there's no certainty it will. And a good example of that is March 2020, when COVID hit the world. The market reaction was so sudden and so sharp that most of the managed future and trend following strategy didn't do well, because it was a very short period of time. And that's why I refer to that crisis alpha that is provided by trend following strategy as a statistical hedge. So in most of the time, it would provide a hedge, but there's no certainty, especially when compared to other kind of hedges, like option-based hedging program that here provide a more certain payout profile, but it comes with a higher cost than managed futures strategies.
And is that something you'd include in your portfolio? Do you have specific tail risk protection option strategies or long vol strategies for that purpose?
So we use managed future trend following strategy within our ARS portfolio, again, to balance the convergence characteristic of other strategies that we have in the portfolio. We also have an allocation to trend following at the total plan level. You can see that as like a risk mitigating program, but that's a program that we need to spend more time on before really being able to call it that way. Ultimately, I believe that program will be a combination of statistical hedge, so those trend following strategies, of more deterministic hedge, like option-based structured program, and some other diversifying strategies. And fixed income can play also a role in that risk mitigating program.
Okay, so very much kind of in line with what we're seeing elsewhere in terms of crisis risk offset portfolios, which are often kind of trend following plus fixed income plus, in some cases, options, and in some cases, kind of global macro type strategies.
Exactly.
You also, interestingly, have 10% leverage in the portfolio, which I guess is something that we see across public pension plans in the US and obviously Canada as well. I mean, what in UPP's case, what's the rationale for that? Is it to kind of boost returns or help with effective portfolio management? Or how do you think about why you have leverage and how much to have?
Yeah, you can use leverage to boost returns, as you mentioned, and that would be by allocating more to return-enhancing assets. It can be used as well to mitigate the risk coming from our liabilities by increasing our allocation to fixed income assets, right? So there's different ways to use leverage. But basically, the goal for leverage is to mitigate the risk coming from our liabilities.
Okay, interesting. So it's largely as a hedging or defensive mechanism.
And it needs to be cautiously managed, and it's a function of the perceived risk that we see on the markets, be it short term or medium term, against relative to our liabilities.
Okay. And I mean, in terms of the portfolio as a whole, then obviously you mentioned you're trying to minimize the volatility of the funding ratio. Do you have a kind of expected return for the overall portfolio, or what does the kind of overall portfolio look like, would you say, from a return kind of volatility kind of characteristic?
Yeah, so we have a discount rate currently of 5.45%, and our objective is to generate returns that will match or be even higher than that discount rate, so as to hedge our liabilities.
Okay. And in terms of risk then, is it around the volatility, or would you have a sense on kind of what the maximum drawdown you would expect of the portfolio?
So we are a new pension plan, and there's still a lot for us to do to improve our portfolio management framework. Today, we look at our portfolio in terms of exposure to asset classes. Ultimately, we want to build a framework that will be focused on risk factors. because ultimately that's what driving the risk return profile of our portfolio. I think it's better to think of the risk of a portfolio through the lens of those risk factors rather than just exposure to the different asset classes, real estate, infrastructure, public equity, and so on.
Yes. So that's kind of the direction you're moving in terms of thinking about exposures. And so would that be kind of the main risks being equity risk, duration risk? I mean, beyond that, and then I guess with absolute return, it's more idiosyncratic, is that it?
Yeah. So liabilities are it's driven by duration risk and inflation risk, because as I mentioned before, we offer to our members inflation indexing. And so a trivial way to look at those liabilities and to look at how to manage those liabilities would be to fully hedge our liabilities through a portfolio of bonds. The problem with that approach is that there's a lot of basis risk between a portfolio of bonds and the liabilities of a pension plan. For example, if you target a yield to maturity for your bond portfolio equal to the liability discount rate, there's a big assumption by doing that. And that assumption is that you will be able to reinvest your bond assets at the same yield than that yield to maturity, which is often not the case. Moreover, in asset liability modeling, liabilities are discounted at the discount rate established by appointed actuaries. And this discount rate usually doesn't move in tandem with the yield of bond assets. The practice is that actuaries will delay and smooth the adjustment of the discount rate. And therefore, the liabilities move slower than the bond assets. So fully hedging your liabilities will be suboptimal. It is also very difficult to hedge the complexity associated with inflation indexing. And adding to the suboptimality of fully hedging your liabilities. And the best approach to manage those liabilities is to invest into a diverse set of assets which will generate stable return greater than the liabilities while managing to minimize the volatility relative to the liabilities. And today, our target hedging ratio is around 41%.
Moving on to kind of the manager selections and the types of managers that you look at. I mean, firstly, maybe on the public equity side, I mean, is that all, do any security selections yourself, or do you favor index funds, or do you like active, or where do you stand in that whole sphere?
We use a mix of passive and active equity investments. As I mentioned before, we believe that the environment we're in and the environment we see going forward will be supportive to active management. So we are more heavily exposed to active public equities and passive equity, but passive equity is an important tool as well in the way we manage our liquidity profile. So we have both in our portfolio. The way we invest in active public equity is solely using external managers. So we don't have any direct investment capabilities for active public markets. We made the decision not to implement those capabilities at the beginning of 2022 because we think that it would be too onerous for a plan of our size to do so. So only external manager for now. That's something that we will revisit in a few years once we grow after acquiring more universities. But for now, all external manager. the portfolio that we are trying to build will be a concentrated portfolio from a number of manager perspective. We think it's the best way to extract alpha from this portfolio. If we have, like, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 managers, the end result is that we will own the markets. And so then why paying fees if it's to replicate the equity market? So concentrated portfolio from a number of manager perspective, and we're targeting 10 to 15 managers. We are striving to build a balanced portfolio across different dimensions, be it geography, be it equity style factors, be it systematic versus discretionary type of strategy. Again, back to what I was saying before, our aim is to build a robust and resilient portfolio across market cycle and economic cycles.
And obviously we talked a little bit about active in equities, but maybe just talking a bit more about the types of strategies and absolute return. You talked about convergent versus divergent. I'm thinking, obviously, with the kind of plan assets around 10 billion, you have the ability to access some smaller niche, more capacity constrained strategies. Is that part of your approach in that sector?
Definitely. We see our size as our edge. So compared to the large pension plan, as you mentioned, we have the ability to invest in more niche strategies, in more capacity constrained strategy, where we believe we can find more alpha than in unconstrained or strategies that can absorb lots of liquidity. Today, we are focusing on rebuilding the core of our portfolio, and we allocate to strategies that have ample liquidity. But next year, we're planning to look at those more niche type of strategy, like ILS, carbon trading, or other type of systematic strategies that focus on a very particular market segment, and that will form what we call a satellite portfolio. So our approach is core, so large core portfolio that will be comprised of strategy with limited liquidity constraints, and then the satellite portfolio, which will be comprised of more niche liquidity constrained strategies.
Okay, interesting. And I mean, within those, I mean, how do you think about finding those opportunities? Is it thinking about areas of the capital markets that are less efficient, or is it just the correlation profile that might be attractive with things like ILS? Or I mean, how do you go about kind of sourcing those types of niche strategies?
So here we talk to a lot of managers every day, every week, every month. Managers that come to us either through cap intro teams at banks, or that reach out directly to us, or managers that we meet at conferences. So that's the main channel for us to source managers. We also use a database, we are screening database to look for risk-return profiles that are differentiated from the risk-return profile already existing in our portfolio. But again, our main channels for sourcing manager is through cap intro conferences and managers reaching out directly to us.
Okay. So maybe, I mean, to give us a sense on, you know, obviously manager selection and evaluation, it's you know, as much art as science. So, you know, and obviously there's always that temptation to be heavily influenced by the track record, et cetera. But I mean, from your perspective, you've been obviously in an allocator seat here, Ontario Teachers as well. I mean, what are the key things that drive your appraisal when you're evaluating a manager?
Yeah, so manager selection requires a deep understanding of the technicalities of the strategies that the managers are running, technicalities that are often complex. In selecting managers, you're not buying a track record. You are buying an investment process that you believe will produce a risk-return profile for your portfolio going forward. And it's critical that you assess the sustainability of that investment process. We all know about the alpha decay. To survive and continue to outperform, a manager should have the capacity to adapt to an ever-changing market environment, to research new strategies, models, and sources of alpha. And so when assessing a manager, it's important, it's critical to have a forward-looking view to assure that, yeah, the manager will be able in the future to generate the risk-return profiles that they have generated in the past. But it's not all about the investment process and the risk-return profile. It's also, there's also many, a myriad of risks that you need to account for and that you need to properly evaluate before making an investment. And those risks can be operational or reputational. And so, yeah, it's not only about investment risk.
Okay. And I mean, obviously, if you're looking at more niche capacity constrained strategies, you're presumably open to looking at smaller managers and where you may be taking on more, maybe, are you open to early stage managers? Or are you willing to take on that kind of early stage manager risk?
Yeah, so we don't have any constraints in terms of how we select manager from that perspective. So we don't require a set level of AUM or a set length of track record. So yes, we can definitely look at emerging manager. What's important is to mitigate the risk that resides with those managers. And one way to do that is through the use of managed account platforms that mitigates some of the risks that you face when allocating to emerging manager. And here I'm thinking mostly operational risk that the managed account platform will provide the infrastructure that will mitigate those kind of risk in an emerging manager.
Okay, interesting. So, I mean, managed accounts, I guess, are increasingly used these days. I mean, it seems to shift a bit. There was a time funds were more popular, now managed accounts. But from your perspective, it's from is the attraction largely that operational, managing that operational risk rather, or is it the transparency as well, or the ability to kind of leverage, or all of the above, I guess?
Yeah, no, all of the above. Investing through managed accounts provide lots of characteristics that makes the investor a better investor. To describe managed accounts, I'm used to use the acronym TLCCC. So T stands for transparency, as you stated. Transparency is very important, not to look at each position that the manager has in their portfolio. It's about being able to aggregate across your hedge fund portfolio all the risk exposure that comes from all the underlying managers. And to me, I've got a quant background, I've got a risk background. And so it's very important to have access to that transparency to be able to properly manage the portfolio. L stands for liquidity. Through the use of managed accounts, you are more in control of the liquidity of your portfolio. And you're less subject to the arbitrary liquidity terms that you can face when allocating through commingled funds. Then the last three C. So the first one stands for control. So you're in control of the assets. You're in control of the third parties that operates around the managed account. be it an audit firm, the administrator, the prime broker. So you're in control. You're in control of the assets as well. They are your assets. And that's a very important feature. The second C is for customization. Being able to customize the strategy with the manager so that it will meet more the needs you have of a given risk return profile within your portfolio is very important. And the last C is for cash efficiency. With the use of managed accounts, you don't need to fully fund, fully cash fund hedge fund investments. Let's take an example here, a managed future manager. So trading only future. This kind of strategy doesn't require high level of cash. You just need to have enough cash to support the margin call coming from your investment activities in future markets. And so instead of funding your investment with 100 million, as you will do when investing in a commingled fund, usually you can support the strategy of a managed future manager with much less cash, like 20 to 30 million. And then you can deploy the cash that you're saving on that side of the portfolio into other investment opportunities in public markets or private markets. So cash efficiency is also a very interesting properties of managed accounts.
Okay, very good. And you mentioned, it's obviously you're buying an investment process. It's not just a track record. But I mean, when you're looking at, say, take CTAs, we both know CTAs and trend followers and managed futures managers very well. You know, there's a lot of good quality firms. There's a lot of people who would kind of tick many of the boxes that an allocator would look for. You know, when it gets to that level that there's a number of different managers that kind of fulfill the basic criteria, you know, what are the extra things that you think you're drawn to that might tip you the decision in favor of one manager over another? Is it around similar philosophies or what it is do you think that are the differentiators between the managers you ultimately go with?
Within given hedge fund strategies, you can have lots of different risk return profile. Let's take an example here. So when you look at managed futures, there are strategies that can be very short term and more relative value versus some that are more medium term, long term, with more directionality, like a trend following strategy. And so I don't really like looking at how your portfolio is allocated through the lens of those high-level type of strategy. So discretionary macro, managed future, equity long short, and so on, or credit relative value. Because what matters at the end is the type of risk return profile that the manager is running. Let me give you an example here. In December, we made an allocation to a credit relative value managers. Often in credit long short, managers are running some beta to the market. There's a beta bias to this kind of strategy. But that's the high level perception of the strategy. Then the way the manager implement their strategy, It can focus on constructing a portfolio that display a positive convexity, meaning that that the manager will still do good in period of market stress, and that manager that we allocated to has actually a risk return profile that has no beta to the market or even a slightly negative beta. And so I think it's important, again, to not look at the high-level strategy denomination that the manager is running, but you need to look under the hood and look at the actual risk return profile that the manager is generating.
Okay. And obviously, we talked about a lot about, you know, manager selection and how you think about that. Obviously, but, you know, that's part of the puzzle. The other part is once you're allocated to managers and the ongoing appraisal, and how do you decide? I guess, obviously, if performance is very good, you'll tend to hold on to them. But you know, obviously, performance might be disappointing, but not necessarily, you know, outside expectations or statistical expectations. So how do you put a framework in place for evaluating managers and deciding, you know, when it's the right decision to remove them?
So you select a manager for the risk return profile that the manager is running, because you think that risk return profile is accretive to your portfolio and has characteristics that will balance the other risk return profile within your portfolio. As long as the manager keeps generating that risk return profile, in my view, there's no reason to fire the manager, even if the manager generates an absolute performance that it can be negative, right? So you need to evaluate the risk return profile that generated by the manager relative to the your expectation and the role that this risk return profile plays in the portfolio. It's totally understandable to me that a manager will underperform or will generate negative performance for a period of time, as long as that risk return profile is in line with your expectation.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, you're allocating to a lot of different strategies, and there's going to be different degrees of sophistication and complexity with the strategies. I'm curious to get your perspective on the challenge of, you know, getting those confirmed or approved through the governance process. Can that be challenging, or maybe give us a sense on what is the governance process for your plan, and are there challenges around kind of educating maybe members of the team who don't come from an investment background?
Yeah, so at UPP, we've got two levels of governance when it comes to making investment decisions. The first level is what we call our Management Investment Committee, which is comprised of our CEO, our CIO, senior members of the investment department, our general counsel, and our CFO. All those people have been in the investment industry for a long time. They are investment professionals. So they understand most of the different asset classes, characteristics. They understand investment strategies. Sometimes it still requires some discussion, some education around some particular investment strategy. But we discuss the strategy. We explain why the resolution profile of a particular strategy will be accretive to our public markets portfolio and to the overall UPP portfolio. And with that understanding of the characteristics that this particular investment will bring to your portfolio, we can make decisions. So MIC, Management Investment Committee. Then we've got an investment committee that is comprised of members of this MIC as well as members of the board. Here, the members of the board that sit on our investment committee, it's a mix of seasoned investment professional as well as less seasoned professionals in the investment space. And here, yes, it requires a bit more education, but I've never had an issue or a misunderstanding of the type of strategies that we invest into. And decisions taken at the IC level are decisions that carry a significant risk for the plan. investment risk, but also operational or reputational strategy. So most of our investment decisions are taken at the MIC level, but when a decision carries more significant risk at the plan level, then it needs to be approved by our investment committee.
Okay, so presumably the investment committee dictates the investment objective, and would they determine the strategic asset allocation, or is that more the management investment committee and then gets approved by the investment committee? Is that the type of process?
The investment committee supervises
our
investment activities. All the work around asset allocation and portfolio management is done at the investment team level.
Yeah. And for things like manager selection, where obviously you'll tend to get a wide variety of perspectives, is decision-making by consensus or by majority, or how do you kind of harness the collective wisdom and get everybody, on board in terms of those decisions?
So usually, and it's been the case until now, decisions are consensual. We discuss new investment opportunity. We address concerns that some members of the investment committee have. And all our decisions have been done so far in a consensual way. But as per our governance, a decision requires only the majority of votes subject to quorum. And it requires as well the affirmative vote of our CIO.
So sometimes people say decision making by consensus. There's pros and cons, but obviously, ultimately, I guess the CIO has the final say. Is that's kind of the overall approach? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, as I said, we need an affirmative vote from our CIO. Then only the majority is required to make an investment decision. But we've never had to get there. All our decisions were made on a consensus basis.
As we get towards the end of the conversation, we like to kind of get kind of advice and perspective from our guests around things that they've found helpful in their careers for people who, are maybe earlier in their journeys. You've obviously had kind of a very, as you say, eclectic background in markets, which I guess has been beneficial for you. I mean, outside of that kind of idea of getting lots of different experience in different asset classes and different roles, what kind of advice would you give to people if they want to develop their skills to be in a position to run an investment portfolio like you do, in terms of things to do or things to read, or any advice around that?
Yeah, so I mean, my main advice is be curious. When I hiring investment professional, I'm looking for people that are passionate about market. What I find fascinating in our industry is the fact that we live in a ever changing world. There's always new financial instruments, new ways to implement a given strategy, new tools at our disposal to invest. I can think here about machine learning, artificial intelligence. So it's using all the tools that we have at our disposal to make the most appropriate investment decision. And so it's very important that you stay on top of all those innovations. You asked me about a book, and here I want to take the opportunity to promote the book that was published last year by a very good friend of mine, Marat Moniboga, that co-wrote that book with Larry Swedrow. The book is called Your Essential Guide to Quantitative Hedge Fund Investing. And this book is looking at hedge fund investing from a quantitative lens. So it first introduces hedge funds, discusses the gap between academia and the industry. It goes on describing approaches to manager selection and portfolio construction through the use of various quantitative methodologies. And it also highlights the importance of diversity and inclusivity in the investment industry. And lastly, it includes interviews of investment professionals who go over their career paths, provide insights on various topics that they are expert in. Those topics going from systematic strategy, emerging market investing, sustainability investing, machine learning, to manager selection and portfolio construction. And I had the pleasure to contribute to that book through being interviewed by Marat.
Very good. Well, that's definitely one to keep an eye out for and for people to look out for. So, Christoph, thanks very much for doing this today. It's been a very enjoyable conversation. Great to hear about your experience and work at UPP. So make sure to follow Christoph's work, because it is important in an uncertain and ever-changing world to understand and consider how to allocate capital well. And we hope that our conversation today has been beneficial in that regard. So from all of us here at Top Traders Unplugged, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back soon with more exciting episodes. So stay tuned.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.